So you are really busy, right?
We grew by 14% with export customers.
Wow.
In 2018, comparing that, the calendar year, comparing that with 2017.
Where's most of the action?
It's beautifully spread across our 43 distributors, and, well, we're so proud of the US. I mean, Steve
yeah.
doing a fabulous job for us as ever, but some of the biggest growth we saw was with Steve and the US, so we're very happy. And although we're busy making some fabulous new amplifiers, which probably you don't want to hear about today.
Well, I always like to hear about whatever you're involved with.
Yeah, we're certainly working hard on some loudspeakers and some amplifiers and things, but certainly turntables, the wonderful thing there is the interest in turntables just seems to keep continuing, which is wonderful.
And do you see a problem with a lot of these this cheap stuff coming in from Taiwan that's some of it looks very good, but it's not particularly well built? Is that creating issues?
I don't think it creates issues for Riga. I think it creates issues for consumers, just because they may or may not be quite poor product, and that's a little sad, because if someone buys a poor product, they might end up with a bad result, and they then might go on to conclude it was just a mistake revisiting vinyl, and
that's
a tragedy.
I agree.
For Riga, well, I think the way we sell Riga, which is only through the very highest quality distribution, and then those distributors seeking out only the very best retailers, then there's less risk for us being sold inappropriately. But generally. And of course, what do we know, Mike? In the last 3 years, the world and his brother have decided they can make a turntable.
Exactly.
Which is predictable. You must have been inundated with, you know, will you review my turntable, Mike?
Oh, yeah, a lot of that.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, yes. I mean, I think probably if you went back 20 years, serious, credible hi-fi manufacturers producing good, credible turntables, there was 6 or 8 or 10 manufacturers globally.
Yep.
Certainly not many. You would know them. You'd be able to name them all.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be at all surprised if today, just companies, even if it's Fred in a shed, I wouldn't be at all surprised if there isn't 200 or 300 again.
Yeah, a lot in China where they'd see, oh, it's easy to make one of those things. I'll make one of those things. If you go online, there are websites that have videos that say, do turntables really make a difference in sound? Can they really sound any different? They're even asking the question, which is, and there are people answering, no, they can't make a difference.
Yeah.
Oh, this is a needle going through a groove and blah 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 blah.
Well, that's where I think your blind enthusiasm for all things vinyl is a good thing.
Yep.
I believe that.
How dare you say it's blind? How dare you?
No, that's probably, I'm using the English language in English terminology
right.
there. What I mean is it's...
Enthusiastic?
Unquestionable.
Yes.
You can't see anything bad in vinyl and just want to keep singing its praises. And that's kind of, for me, gives a bit of a balance to this other possible... side where,
yeah. Well,
you can never really blame the public, can you? You know, they're unlucky, they're in the wrong town, there's not a good dealer, they hear about vinyl again, and they think, oh, for whatever reason, do you know what, I'm going to give that a go. They go in the wrong shop, they buy a very mediocre product, and their experience becomes bad. And that's just sad.
In all honesty, you can't imagine how many emails I get every week about people saying, I tried vinyl, I'm loving it, thank you. You know, I read your stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't gotten any... no one's ever sent me an email saying, I tried it, it sucks. No one. I mean,
yeah,
literally
well, that's
no
brilliant.
One.
That's good news.
It's very good news. It's very
yeah,
good
yeah,
news.
Yeah, it is. But also, something that I think is... and here, I'm talking to someone my age. Vinyl's never been new to you, apart from when you was a teenager. And what we can both remember, if you go back to the 60s or 70s, or 80s even, actually, is that there was an awful lot of poor vinyl about. Yeah, and you would, you know, if you bought 10 albums a month, which is, when I was young, I couldn't afford that, actually, I'm exaggerating, but say you bought one a week, inevitably, in the 70s, and particularly the 80s, you'd end up taking at least one of them back, because it wasn't pressed very well.
Well, you know what, two things about that. First, in the late 60s, I remember seeing the cheapening happening. Even in the jackets,
yeah.
They went from the really nice cardboard and paper over cardboard jackets. The records got thinner and thinner. They were so thin they looked like something out of a Salvador Dali painting. And then it got really bad. But you know what? That's kind of happening again to a certain degree, and it's kind of concerns me. I see them making money, putting money above quality, and that's never a winning combination.
And I think it's good. What we need to do is, so many folks new to vinyl that there needs to be some way of warning them that, no, look, stick with it. It's okay to take something back, you know, if you think you've got a bad recording, bad pressing, sorry, should I say.
You're right. If you go to a record store,
you
go to a record store, Phil, and you'll see the same album, three different versions. One is $20. One is $25, or one is $40, and there's no differentiation in the bin where it says, here's why this one's $40, here's why this one's $20, nothing.
But, you know, I still pinch myself, Mike, because, you know, well, I'm 60 years old now, I've been making these things for 39 years, and how lucky am I?
I don't remember 60.
Come on.
I don't.
Come on.
That's really? Almost 12 years ago.
Wow, man! Well, you're looking good.
I'm feeling great. I've never felt or looked better. I'm telling you, I'm in the best shape. I've been working out and really, you know, trying to.
Yeah, I think age brings benefits as well, not really experience, if nothing else, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know.
So now let's talk about this new turntable. So
yeah, of course, yeah.
So you've come out with a new P8. I get confused about the way they're described. So the last one, the one that's just retired, is also a P8, or was that a planar 8?
No, the one that's just finished, it was an RP8.
Okay, RP8.
And relatively straightforward. The R stood for Riga, P for planar, and it was the numeric 8.
Okay.
And that generally, with turntables at Riga, the higher the number, the higher the performance of the turntable.
Yes. And the new one is a P8.
It's planar 8. The
because Riga no longer makes it. Is that the reason?
Well, it's really I need to make sure this doesn't sound how I don't want it to sound. If we're very, very happy with what we've done, not that we're ever not happy to release something to the public,
right?
But if we feel we've really nailed something, if it's available and if it's free, we'll use our original name. And I think it wasn't the first turntable, but the first turntable that Roy, I think, really felt, now I've nailed this, was the very original Planar 3, back in the mid-1970s.
Right.
And so for us to give a new turntable the moniker Planar, we're very pleased with it.
So that's a sign of respect. So that's interesting. I'm glad you explained
it
because
I didn't really know that. And there's never been a Planar 8. There's never been one. So that's why we felt we could use the name.
Good. So now, one of the differences in this turntable is that you realize the whole infrastructure of providing the outer a piece with the dust cover was kind of a waste, really. It was a way of giving people a dust cover, but it also created, it was like, why?
Right, okay. First of all, yes, you're right with the reasons, but that isn't how it evolved, actually. Probably the most important thing about the Planar 8, and the Planar 8 is the first of a trilogy of turntables, and the Planar 8 was never conceived as an evolution of RP8.
Oh, really?
So, no, it wasn't. We're getting to a period in Riga's history where really I'm doing quite a lot of the turntable tone arm cartridge design with Roy, my guru. Okay? So he's the one guiding me. I'm doing quite a lot of the the generation of the design, and then I've got a wonderful team of people that helped me create it.
So you conceived of this design?
This is the idea. Yeah. The idea. And I can tell you exactly how it happened. I think you've seen when you visited us last a research project called NIAID.
Yes, I see how one inspired the other.
Yes, exactly that. So through a very long, nearly 10-year process of a massive learning process for me, and for me, not that I ever lacked confidence in Roy. He's the most amazing engineer for many reasons. But that was a wonderful learning, educational process for me. So having to lead that as a project from start to finish was like the most wonderful master's degree course you could ever have in how to design a turntable. And all it did for me was to endorse for me that Roy's base philosophies are right. He's got a wonderful, clear way of using laws of physics and engineering and how you need to apply them to create a turntable.
Right.
If you want to extract information from that tiny groove with its little ridges in it, if you really want to read all those little ridges, if you really want to keep that diamond in contact with them all the time, then these are the philosophies you need to follow.
Right.
So the NIAID project really started giving me real confidence. You know, with knowledge comes power and confidence, and I became more and more confident. And there were things about the RP8 and the RP10 that I felt, we can improve this, you know. But now I've built I think I've now built, including prototypes, something like 15 NIAIDs. They're a bit of a labour of love.
And those are for sale?
Kind of. I'm very hesitant because it's got so many compromises with assembly that I would never inflict it on a production team. It'd just be unfair. So to this point in time, with a colleague of mine, Annette, we build every one, and it's very unusual for Riga. They're a bit handcrafted. They take a lot of time, and I have to find the time outside of my normal day job to do that.
Okay, now before we go any further, because I know people have seen that video and they've seen what that looks like, and it's awesome. So the question is, do you think in the future you'll be able to figure out a way to actually build those on a production line the way you build other things, or is it by definition impossible?
It's impossible. Yeah. Yes, we could build them. I think we could probably build them if we had the time and the infrastructure. One thing which is a constant challenge for us at the moment is the world constantly wants more Riga. So a fair amount of our energy at the moment constantly goes into achieving just that. So making more of what we've already created.
I get you. Now, have you literally run out of space? Because when I was there, you were just about out of space. You were building things in the hallways. Is it that?
No, absolutely. In fact, I tried to purchase an adjoining factory a year ago, but that didn't happen. So we've had to introduce some new ideas, and we've just finished putting in a 3,500 square foot new floor in the front factory.
Wow.
So now the front factory that you've been in has a complete first floor. So that's created quite a lot of additional production space.
So it used to be like open space below a certain
point. Yes, if I don't know if you can recall, if you remember where the loudspeakers were produced,
yep.
There was no first floor in that part of the
that's
factory.
Right. Now let me ask you this question. When you did that, how did you lose production time and did it mess up your schedule?
No, we've got... it made the schedule much more complex because we also decided to put a new state-of-the-art roof on the whole front building, the whole production building.
Oh.
So, and we couldn't stop production. So, but we've got one member of the team here. You know, everyone's called coordinators.
Yep.
And we have one coordinator, Michael, who is a sublime project manager. And over the years, Riga's done many building projects, and... he loves building projects. and he's so good now that together with Michael we came up with a plan where we didn't stop production, but we completely re-roofed the factory, and we built this floor now. One nice benefit of this floor isn't just to give us more production capacity, actually. It's also, for the first time in our history, we're going to have a 70-seat canteen. And we've recruited a cook, and we'll be giving everyone in the factory a hot meal every day.
Oh, that's nice.
We obviously think that we'll do that for everybody. They're a fabulous group of people, and we think that's, you know, another good thing to do for everybody.
Well, wasn't there a tremendous amount of dust involved in...
There's an awful lot of sheeting covering up, air extraction. You have to do. The materials you use, we're careful with those. And then in July this year, we're looking to start building a new separate building on the back of the site.
Wow.
So that's the growth is perpetually continuing. But to go back to your question about NIAID, in the dream world, where me and Annette could just build NIAIDs every day, just come into work and that's all we would do, we would be able to produce a NIAID about every 2 days. So they are very slow, and but you know, we would probably produce maybe 15 a month or something. But that's only part of the issues. Just to get the parts together for the first 50 NIAIDs took me 1.5 years. So the production and the manufacturing of the parts is incredibly difficult, some of them.
Right.
So that would be an issue as well.
So it's unobtainium. It's unobtainium in the real world.
I think if you're enormously patient with Riga, we're slowly working around a number of our distributors that have, I don't think it's too strong a word to say, almost bullied us into giving them one.
Yeah, I know someone who's got one, but I'm not going to mention them.
Yeah.
No names mentioned.
And with those distributors, what we're saying is, look, okay, here's a price structure for you to sell one to a customer, but this is the deal. You have to do it directly.
Right.
Yes, you can involve a retailer if you want, but someone factory trained with the NIAID has to go to that person's room and work through that with them, installing it and giving them. This is the most expensive thing we've ever produced. Our heart and soul's in it.
Yeah.
We do not want any stone left unturned in how we give somebody one of these and then how we make it work for them. And that could never be a quick process. So what we're saying to the distributors that have a NIAID, and we're saying, well, okay, if the person is right, because it has to be so right for the person,
right.
If you think you found a NIAID person, okay, we'll look at selling them one, but we can't give you a lead time.
Right.
So there's a lot of understanding needed.
So back in the real world, you were completely in charge of designing the new P8.
Yeah, it's not really our culture. I would say I was...
Project manager?
Not in charge. Yeah. Not in charge, no. I would have been the person wanting it to happen initially, convincing my teammates, including Roy, about the direction, and then working with them to create it.
Okay, so now what I see...
That's the way I'd rather put it.
What I see is a turntable where you've actually decreased the mass. It appears to...
Yes. Well, first and foremost, if you look at a P8 and you see a picture of a NIAID, the P8 is a baby NIAID. It's really following a lot of the NIAID design principles when you're on a much, 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 much smaller budget.
Right.
And there's a tiny shift here and there away from the NIAID in where you're placing your design compromises, but that's only because of budget. And of course, this is a turntable that we need, have, want to give to a production team, and we want that team to have no problems producing it. So this turntable is quicker, and I would say slicker to build than the RP8.
Now,
we've learned.
Are the similarities, because I haven't looked at the NIAID in a while, but are the similarities in terms of the size of the main structure and the way that it's cut out and the shape of it? Is that what?
Not so much specific physical attributes, more in the key areas that we would look at for the performance of the turntable, how the relationship between the main hub bearing and the tone arm, how that is stiffened, how stiff the plinth is, how have we reduced the mass in the plinth where we don't want mass, how we've dealt with mounting the motor into the plinth, how we've dealt with the main hub bearing assembly. We've made another area we've realised that in it looks like a minutiae change physically, but has an effect on the turntable that's quite significant with its performance, is making sure that we're removing potential energy from all key areas of the turntable. Old Rigas would have had potential energy because of how we were maybe mounting the hub bearing in the plinth, or how we were mounting a tone arm in the plinth.
So these are all
the areas in a line.
How are you mounting the hub assembly into the plinth?
This is where you get a significant change to, say, an RP8. We're using the same method as we used in the new Planner 6, actually. But the most significant thing here is there's, in between the two stiffening braces, which are on the top and the bottom of the plinth and run between the main hub bearing and the tone arm, there's bonded inside the plinth, you can't see this, is a high quality, very accurately machined aluminium boss. And that boss is carrying a Riga designed thread. It's a very coarse thread and a very fast thread, so it tightens down and locks very quickly. And the main hub bearing now carries that thread, and you literally screw the hub bearing from the top, so it with a flange on the hub bearing, it will screw down, it will locate onto the brace and lock into this aluminium base that's in the middle of the plinth.
And stay there for many years, forever.
Oh yes, yeah. It's got, because of the design of these special threads, they have a natural locking capability, if you like.
And do you have that manufactured for you, or do you actually make that in-house?
Oh yeah, no, we have that manufactured for us. We do a very small amount of manufacturing on site, but because we don't want to be restricted as designers in any material, any new manufacturing process or any technology, for Riga to manufacture all its own parts, it would have to have such a large factory.
It doesn't make sense at this point, I'm sure.
No, that's right.
Aerospace industry and the aeronautics.
Oh, yes. Well, to quickly recap, we're involved in compression moulding, transfer moulding, injection moulding, high-pressure die casting, sand casting, CNC lathe machining, CNC milling machining, CNC glass, CNC ceramics, laser cutting, water jet cutting. The list is a bit endless. On the supply side of Riga, I mentioned earlier we have 43 customers in essence, 43 export distributors.
Wow.
And then the 44th is our UK distribution. On the supply side of Riga, there's over 600 companies.
Wow.
And at least 250 of those are close relationships where we've worked with them to design a part bespoke to Riga that we want manufactured in a very specific way. I mean, so much so, I think you've met Roy's son, Kai.
Yeah.
His job role is just supporting and working with all these special suppliers, these important suppliers.
I think people will be amazed to hear that there are 600 companies involved in the manufacturing. That's a lot.
Yeah, Riga has has become, in the UK, I think we're termed a medium-sized company now, but the numbers, yeah, when you stop and look at the numbers, even sometimes we now go, oh. So on a typical month, we will process through, between, depending on the sales, between 6 and 8 million component parts.
Now, let's get back to the specifics of the turntable. Is the,
yep, sure.
The foam that you, I'll call it foam, it's not really... Is it correct to call it foam, or is that an incorrect word to use?
In the plinth structure?
Yeah.
Yes, no, that's a foam. Yeah, that's a foam, absolutely.
And is that a different foam than you used on the...
It is a different foam from the RP8. And this foam has some new advantages. The material it's made from is a polyurethane rather than a polyolefin. So this is, so they're polymers, as the names suggest, so you can almost view them like plastics, I guess.
Right.
So when they're set, when they're foamed and they're finished in their finished form, the new foam, the polyurethane foam that we're using, it's a product called Tankcast 8, or a variant of that, should I say, specific to us, it's more brittle, or it's harder, is the way of describing it. Okay, now that help contributes in a number of ways to making a superior plinth. It's easier to machine accurately, and it's stiffer, and particularly the type of polyurethane foam we're using is lower in mass than the polyurethane. So they're all beneficial improvements over what we did with RP8. Yeah. The real tricky bit, Mike, was actually making it black.
Really?
Not tricky, yeah, they'd never done that before.
What's the natural colour of the foam?
Typically, actually, it's either a creamy, nothinky colour or quite a bright blue.
Bright blue?
Yeah.
Oh, that wouldn't work too well. That's not your
colour. Neither of which were kind of working too well. If you saw the first prototypes... They weren't pretty.
So, but you eventually figured out a way to make it black. And what did you do? You painted it black like Mick Jagger or some other thing?
Oh, no. Chemistry.
But
chemistry in the foaming process. And we also do a special process on the foam once it's a finished plinth. We use an American product, actually. I don't know if you know, but America is one of the foremost providers of specialist PVA adhesives, which are used in the art world and antiquities world. So we're using an American product, and you know, I think you probably know what I mean by PVA adhesive.
What
is that? Water-soluble, coloured white PVA.
PVA?
PVA. PVA, yeah, cheap derivatives of this are used as adhesives for gluing wood together, timber. And in this more exotic blend, this American product we're using, it's used, it's also a material. PVA adhesives are water soluble, you mix them with water, make them thinner. They're also used for sealing surfaces. Sealing a surface. So, if you've got a very precious painting or a very old manuscript and you want to protect it from any further decay, this American product is often used by museums or artisans to protect, because when you apply it, it's very, very thin, very low viscosity, and it dries completely clear. You have no evidence whatsoever it's there. And we use that on the surface of this foam.
And how is it applied?
And skill, dexterity. It's actually applied by a person with a brush.
Wow. And then does it get sanded, or it actually comes, it just...
No, it just sinks into the foam, and it dries completely transparent. You've no idea it's there.
But no, you don't. It looks great.
Yeah.
So now... What about the hub itself? Is the bearing and all those parts, are those new, or are those similar to previously used?
They're quite new, but they are the same design as the Planner 6.
Hmm. And two belts. Are the belts exactly the same, or are they slightly different?
No, this is one of the more exciting things. Over the last few years, we've been working with a chemist in the rubber industry in the UK, who sadly has just retired, but a hugely experienced guy. And we wanted to improve the performance of our drive belts. And currently, most of our turntables use a material called a polychloroprene. It works quite well. We're quite happy with it. But I worked with this chemist from a clean sheet of paper saying, well, his name is Michael, funnily enough. Mike, you know, look, if we wanted to do a superior drive belt, we know if we make a more accurate drive belt, a drive belt with particularly round, particularly accurate, we will be improving the drive belt. But is there anything we can do with material? And he thought there was. And we started trialling a material called EPDM.
EPDM?
EPDM. I won't try and remember the name.
No, it doesn't matter.
Not on a recording. I'm only going to get it slightly wrong. It's ethyl polyethylene diamine. Anyway, I'll be getting that wrong right now. Anyway, EPDM. Now, this material has a superior modulus. So the way it's cross-linked as a material, this means that compared to the current material we use, say on a Planar 1, this new belt has a more even stretch or more even compression. It's a more accurate material. So this is giving us a much better drive characteristic for the turntable. Mm. So what's the main advantage when you're listening? Well, the main advantage is we've improved the speed stability of the turntable,
right,
this drive belt. One of the biggest Achilles heels for many turntables out there are their drive belts. And, you know, some you look at and you can only smile, really. I was shown a photograph of a turntable last week, and they did say that the drive belt is monofilament. Well, it's fishing line.
Well, I know, there's a lot of that out there.
Yeah, which is not really a good material for this purpose for many reasons.
But anyway, it's always got a knot in it that they sort of don't think makes a difference.
Yeah, well, yep. But I don't want to talk about other people. But, so we got this wonderful new drive belt. So not only have we made a big step forward with the material itself, but again, something Roy's been passionate about that we've been pushing for is looking for new moulding techniques, which is still going on right now today, for making an ever more accurate belt. And I think when you were last here, you would have met a young guy, Ashton, who works for us, who's, if you recall, he was the young graduate who actually emigrated from America to work for us.
Yes, and he was in the front room there,
Yeah, we're very proud of that, and Ash continues to contribute to Riga. And one of the things he's done for us, I made a request that can we have a much more accurate testing system for turntables. I wanted to see all sorts of aspects of speed of the turntable, and over a couple of years or so, he's come up with the most amazing system that not only is it a great production tool, but to have as a development tool, it's like somebody giving you a lottery win.
Oh.
So now I can see instantaneous speed changes, you know, as part of one revolution, for example.
Well.
You know, how much did it speed up or slow down from 33 1/3 RPM in one revolution?
Wow.
What's the mean average speed over several revolutions? Is the turntable speeding up for 10 revolutions, then slowing down for 10 revolutions, then speeding up for 10 revolutions? Suddenly, to be able to see all these things really clearly, really accurately, with good measurements you can trust, enables you to analyse the designs you've been trying. So we could see, for example, when we first had good working examples around 2 years ago now of the EPDM drive belt, we actually trialled one on an RPA. We trialled two, actually, of course.
Yeah.
But we trialled them on an RPA, and it transformed the measurement of the turntable so it came into the same specification then as the RP10.
Wow.
on speed.
So now, are you going to use this belt throughout the line, or through the top end of the line, or just...
Well, our ambition is to use derivatives of EPDM over the next few years across every single turntable we make. And but there will be, we're hoping there will be different quality levels.
Right.
Where we're now, actual fact, we're now experimenting with different types of, or different... cure systems for EPDM, and we're also working with getting ever more accurate EPDM belts physically.
Right.
So, yes, our ambition is to end up with more than one EPDM belt, actually. And the reason we want to extend EPDM over the whole range is because it's also more tenacious. It will last longer.
Right.
It's just a better belt.
Yeah. Now, so the hub itself is aluminum?
The subplatter is, yes.
Subplatter, yeah. It's aluminum. And
yep.
Have you used this brass platter with the peripheral ring? Have you used that before? I can't remember.
Yes. Dimensionally, the Planar 8 platter is the same as the RP8 platter, but we're using completely different glass.
Oh.
If you look at the Planar 8 platter, have you got one in front of you, mate?
I can take it off. I can get it.
Well, that's not a problem. When you're next with it, if you look at it on the edge of the platter, you'll see there's three pieces of glass that have been bonded together. And really what we're demonstrating here, obviously, is that the turntable, one of the special aspects of this platter is it has flywheel effect.
Right.
And we're achieving that by gluing different size rings together to form a finished platter. And what we've done is to have a sandwich of different glasses. So what we're really demonstrating there is what we think is now our prowess in manufacturing very, very accurate glass platters, multi-piece platters, and we're even showing you different pieces of glass to now show you where the joints are. And obviously, some people think it gives an appealing aesthetic, but you'll see that we've actually got what's termed a grey glass. It looks quite dark black.
Right.
And then there's actually opti-clear glass, which is a very clear white glass.
And that must not be easy to make because it's bonded, and it has to be machined. Is that machined, that glass? How's that?
Yeah, well, yes, it's CNC machined. It's a very intricate process which we developed with a very special, small, family-owned company in the East Anglia region of the UK. A father and son company. They're very, very special. There's a bit about them in the Riga book, actually, yeah. Young Dan.
It's all about the family, so.
Yeah, and yes, the way we've developed over what is now around 10 years, the use of UV curing adhesives, we sponsored with them buying in state-of-the-art CNC machines from Italy. And Dan is just a wizard with programming and getting the most from these machines. So initially we made jigs for those machines here in Riga, and it took us quite some time to achieve a super accurate platter, but it's becoming a finely tuned process now that we're very happy with. But again, the accuracy of a platter and things like flywheel effect are really quite critical for its sound performance.
Yeah.
And the materials it's made from are critical. The accuracy of speed control of a turntable is a real factor in getting more accurate information out of the record groove.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about so we've talked about the plinth, we've talked about the platter, we've talked about the subplatter and the hub. And is there a difference in the bearing itself, the hub, you know, the hub itself, or is that...
It's a very modern Riga hub. It's, as I mentioned earlier, it's this new design that screws down from the top,
right,
that eliminates any potential energy that might get stored in the plinth through the plinth being squashed or put under stress.
Now what about the actual bearing itself? Is there Is it a bronze?
The bearing is a specific grade of brass.
Okay. Right, okay.
And the spindle itself is a special hardened steel, which is an EN31 from memory. But that's a carbon steel.
Yeah.
That needs to be hard to do its job. But while we're talking about that, one thing quickly again, and this is mentioned in the Riga book again, this is something that's really quite important about our hub bearing platter designs. And we've got a little tool that we must... We're calling it a toy. I'm not sure if we should have done, but it is a toy. The principles that go right back with Roy to his first designs were understanding the principles of where you put the mass of the platter and the subplatter versus the length of the bearing spindle. And this is a very critical dimension. If you get it right, if you have an understanding of gyroscopic effect, you can, and if you position mass away from the center of gravity, okay, you will have a more stable platter hub bearing assembly. But its natural instinct will be to keep itself vertical, which is the attribute you want. You don't want this big heavy platter constantly trying to slump to one side.
No.
This will just cause friction in your hub bearing assembly.
Right.
Now, to our knowledge, looking at all other turntables we've seen, no one else seems to adopt this principle. And what we've got is, we've called it a toy. We must... if you email me your address again, mate, so I've definitely got the right one, I'll email you one of these, because we're sending them to all of our distributors and dealers to help demonstrate the principle.
Great, yeah, so very helpful in writing this up.
Yeah, sure, and you'll see it's quite an attractive little, looks like an aluminium mushroom with a post in the middle. And what you do is you spin it with your finger and thumb on a tabletop, so sort of thing you would have done before. And you spin it as fast as you can, and as it slows down, you'll be a little bit shocked in what it does. It looks as though it should spin in the position and stay in the position you've spun it, because you've got quite a big, heavy mushroom head, okay?
Right.
With a spindle coming out the middle of it that you've spun it on. And what you'll see it do, and it kind of, first time you see it, you kind of think, what's going on here? It will flip itself upright and start spinning on the central spindle that you spun it on. And it kind of defies what you think will happen. But it demonstrates this principle of how important it is where you put mass. And it's particularly applicable. So what's going on with this little toy is what's going on for a turntable.
That's fascinating. So... okay, let's move on to the particulars here. I want to keep everybody listening's attention. So, the feet, is there anything new in the feet?
Well, it is a new design. We first pioneered it with the Planner 6. It's a very functional foot. It's doing all the things a foot needs to do. It's got a reasonable grip characteristic with whatever surface you put it on. It's a material called Santoprene, which gives a sensible level of isolation without becoming too soft and damping the whole turntable. That would be really quite bad again.
Yep.
For getting information from the vinyl. And the new moulding has, it's quite a complex moulding actually, with a lot of sectional areas in it. So in other words, it's hollowed out. So the whole assembly with its aluminium mount is really very light for a foot that size. So again, you can see that's quite important. If we'd have done this lovely light rigid plinth and then put great heavy feet on it, that would have been a bit of a silly thing to do.
Yes, it would have defeated the purpose. So then...
yeah, exactly.
So, okay, two other things. So then you eliminated the hinged dust cover and you put a functional heavy molded or curved plastic piece that covers the arm and and the platter when you're not using it, and then you just lift it off, and then you're ready to play records, and then you put it back on, which makes a lot of sense to me.
Yes, it was a compromise we were happy to make, because being influenced by the Naiad, this is the route the Naiad went, because another really important thing with the Planar 8 compared to the RP8, the turntable is actually smaller.
Yes.
It's physically smaller. The feet are not in the same position. It's a smaller turntable. So, and again, the outer frame, it, although with the RP8, RP10, we took, put a lot of work in isolating it from the main plinth, it's still going to add weight to whatever the turntable's on. So, again, taking a sort of more purist route, we thought, no, we're going to make this plinth smaller, lighter, more rigid, so we cannot have any form of frame for a dust cover either. So that led us to the direction of having a dust cover similar to the Naiad. So it's relatively straightforward. It locates onto the centre hub, same as a record would, and in the middle of the rear foot, in the plinth actually, there's a locating hole which takes a spindle on the dust cover. So this gives you a nice, easy place on, take off system.
And it is.
But it also stops rotation.
Yes, it is, because I take it out and put it back on every day. And
okay, cool.
It's a pleasure. I don't leave it off because I don't want any dust again. Okay, so that's another change that I think is very useful. It changes the whole idea of a hinged dust cover, and we know that in the presence of vibrations, the dust cover vibrates, and then it gets through everything, and it's not the greatest thing. So, now, the arm, is there anything new in the arm?
Yes, there is, actually. Now, the arm is an evolution of the RB330, and we're calling it the 880, 880, whatever you wish there. One way you can identify the change, it's relatively subtle. If you look at the side of the tone arm, at the vertical bearing housing where it attaches to the plinth itself, you'll see there's small windows in the plastic bearing bias housing, and you'll see through into there, you'll see there's aluminium, and we have a brand new super rigid aluminium stainless composite vertical bearing housing. So this is generally increasing the performance of the tone arm over, say, the 330 that you would find on a 6 or a 3.
And then are you using your best bearings in there?
Yes, we're using, all of our bearings are pretty good now. Even we did pioneer in the cheaper products. We've designed a polymer bearing in Germany, which we currently use in the cheaper product.
Right.
And there's a possibility in the future, because those are lubricant free, that we might actually be able to have a very, very high performance polymer bearing, but that's for the future. At the moment, this tone arm is using very, very high quality. It's a Japanese manufacturer called NMB. A very high quality ABEC bearing.
Yeah. Now this turntable includes a motor drive system that can be tweaked if necessary. But that's new.
Yep, it is. The product has a name of its own. It's called Neo, the power supply you have there.
What's it called?
Neo, N-E-O.
Neo, okay.
Neo, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And yes, this power supply has a degree of simple computer control. So yes, it has a mode on the back, which you, with an appropriate tool, which is a small specialist type of screwdriver.
Yeah, which you supply.
Yep, you can just put the unit into program mode, and then in an adjacent hole, there's a rotary control, and you can make small speed step adjustments of a little less than 0.1% fast or slow, depending which way you rotate the control.
Right.
And we do offer now for customers, obviously that's a good facility, particularly in the field, if a Riga technician is working on a turntable for a customer.
Right.
But if a customer wanted to adjust the speed, it's what can they use to adjust the speed. Now there are, we've worked with one of these guys actually, there are some quite nice apps now available for telephones, but there's a bit of an issue there with calibration, and it might be that unless you really read the detail on these systems, if you've not calibrated your app, it might give you, that the reading could be out, and some of them are accurate, some of them are not, and that's not necessarily because of the app, it can be because of the quality of the equipment inside the telephone.
Right.
What we have done is to provide, a bit typical of Riga, quite a nice, relatively accurate strobe that you can buy from us as a little accessory kit.
Right.
With a light pen that's giving you a nice frequency that you'll be able to hold the light against the strobe, and the old-fashioned way, I'm sure you've done this a few times, you'll be able to watch whether the graduations are going clockwise or anti-clockwise to adjust the speed of the turntable.
Right. Well, that's good. That's good. So essentially, and the price point of this turntable is very surprisingly, I think it's actually lower than the other eight.
It's well, depending on the country, it's probably very slightly more. It's very, very close. But what we're so driven by giving high value for money. We think it's one of the reasons why Riga is liked by a lot of people is they feel they get good value from us.
You know what else I like Riga, because once it's set up, it stays set up.
Oh yeah, sure.
It doesn't need a lot of tweaking and adjusting, and things don't run out of parameters, you know.
Yes, this Planner 8, it's absolutely as robust, as easy to use as a Planner 3. Absolutely. And that would be part of the brief for design, though. To achieve those things. But what we would like to think with the Planner 8 is we're really raising the bar with information retrieval from the vinyl, which does relate if you get a nice, well-pressed, well-recorded, dare I say it, analogue recorded vinyl, this thing we're hoping will blow your mind a little bit.
I have a few of those records. In fact, I'm putting
I'm not surprised. I bet you have.
I'm putting a list together of 100 all analogue recordings that you should own. That I don't mean you, I mean people.
Oh, yeah.
It's really obnoxious to do that because everybody's got different musical tastes. So telling people they should own a particular record is really ridiculous.
No. I don't think so. And I'll tell you for why. I've got a wonderful friend who's been involved. In fact, he sold Riga for over 45 years. And a huge music fan, particularly passionate, he's a pianist as well, and he's particularly passionate about classical music. But with regards almost anything, and often this crops up for us with regards food, and what Tony always says is when somebody goes, "Ah, yeah, but I hate broccoli, can't stand broccoli,"
right,
or whatever, he'll go, "It's because you've never had a good one yet."
Right.
And there's so much truth in that.
Yes.
And numbers of, there's some guys in Riga and girls where we've been playing music and they would go, "Well, I'd never normally listen to this, but it sounds so stunning that I'm appreciating it."
Yes.
You know?
Yep, that's how I got into big band music. I said, "I don't think I want to hear big band music." And I got into it because it was so good sounding. And then I got into Duke Ellington, and then I got into Count Basie. And pretty soon, I was a big band fan. That's how it works.
Yeah.
That's the fun of vinyl, too.
Yeah. And, you know, I, broadly speaking, I listen now. In fact, I was a little lonely. Well, you'll probably think I'm a Philistine now. But the year before last, I got to see Elton John in concert. It was one of the last concerts he would probably do with most of his original lineup.
Right.
You know, Davy Johnson, et cetera. And the first album I ever bought was "Don't Shoot Me, I'm the Only Piano Player."
Yeah.
Okay, there's a thread running through my life with music, but there's music I listen to now I'd never have done when I was 16. You know?
Yep.
So yeah, that's another great thing about life. As you go through it, it's something when you was young, you went, well, I'll never listen to that, I'll never do this, or never do that. Of course, you give it 20 years, and you end up loving it.
Anyway, this was great. So this is really a completely new, from the ground up product, despite its similarities on a very basic level.
If you put a Planner 8 next to an RP8, it becomes a bit more striking just how different it is.
Right. It would be interesting to have both playing at the same time, but I don't have that ability. But it would be interesting to hear the difference.
Oh yeah, I'd love to do that for you, because you know it's literally 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, and you just start laughing.
Yeah, but I understand
that. And the RP8 was a very well thought of turntable,
yes,
that we're still very proud of.
Yes.
But the Planner 8 really does put it to the sword, frankly.
I understand that. Believe me, I understand that. In all of the work I've done, I've heard differences in, you know, new products that look similar to old products, but like the arm that I use, which is stupidly expensive, though the new one is looks the same, but it's much,
yeah,
much better.
I kind of... Beauty's in the eye of the beholder. I would always draw back a bit. We could name products now, couldn't we? That are £250,000 or $500,000 even. I would never say, personally, I wouldn't say, oh, they shouldn't exist and why on earth would you pay that much? There's going to be somebody out there that it's right for them.
Yes.
Or they have that much disposable income, or, you know.
Yes, I know. I've met a lot of those people, fortunately.
Yeah.
They're fun to hang out with. They break out some really good wine.
Yeah, I bet they do, yeah.
And you can taste, and you can taste, and you can taste the difference.
And particularly comfortable settees.
Yes, even when they're the kind of person that doesn't say, hey, I'm going to open a bottle of $2,000 wine now. They just bring it. And they open it and they pour it. And they don't say anything. And they don't show you the bottle. They just make believe it's a normal thing. And you take one sip and you go, "Oh my God, what is that? I've never had anything like that."
Yeah.
I had that experience a couple of weeks ago. It was amazing.
I think our quest, if we have such a thing, is to keep finding those like-minded Riga people all around the world. That over 45 years, we've discovered there's more than enough of them to keep us busy making things.
Absolutely.
But we do realise that every few years we need to try harder for them and give them something new where they go, great, either they're new to it and they discover it, or if they're old Riga people, when not old in age, but they've had Riga previously, they go, fabulous, you've given me more of what I wanted.
That's the most fun, isn't it? Isn't the most fun when you come up, when you improve a product that was already great, and the people that own the original one, they don't go, how come you didn't do this originally? Why couldn't you do this, 10 years ago? They go, oh, you've worked and you've improved it. You've made it better.
Yes.
Based upon your
yes.
principles, which you've never deviated from, which I admire a great deal.
Well, you know, we are what we are. Riga is a huge reflection on Roy and his personality. There's things that he demands in life from his personality, which are natural things that he feels very passionate about,
yep.
or that he's not prepared to compromise on. And some of them are the most important things that, like in this conversation, we haven't touched on very much, which is, say, the reliability of a product.
Yes.
I mean, if the team here makes something, designs something, should I say, and we present it to him, and it's got a real fault in it, a real failing, that it's going to let a customer down, he will be deeply upset.
Yeah.
You know, and these are wonderful attributes. You know, they're, I'm absolutely unashamed in saying that I can only do now what I do now, because of working with him for 39 years.
Right. Now, is there anything new that you're working on that you can tell us about, or should we hold off?
There is, but I don't want to give any distributors or retailers heart attacks.
Okay.
We're always developing new products, and the typical gestation period, apart from NIAID, is typically around 3 years. So.
Right.
We'll be working on more turntables, more amplifiers, more speakers.
And do you see being able to transfer a lot of what you learned on this turntable to less expensive turntables?
Yes, and in fact, really, that process has already started to some degree, because certainly Planner 3, Planner 6, the two current turntables there, were heavily influenced by the NIAID work, but just not to the degree the Planner 8 was.
Right.
So that's already happening. So.
Well, listen, I'm sure you have a lot of work to do today, as your day is kind of winding down. But
we've got a little way to go yet, but
yes. So this was very, very informative, and I think especially informative, well, for writing about it, it's informative, but also it's informative because people, if they look at the turntable, they see familiarity, and they need to really understand that what looks familiar is actually very, very different. So.
Yes, I mean, we barely touched on the fact this is the first mass-produced Riga to have the turntable motor mounted in from the bottom with a new method.
Well, but don't hang back.
Well, it's a method that is holding the motor in a more rigid way, but isolating it more than before. Oh. So it's almost like having your cake and eat it.
Yeah, those are two sometimes mutually exclusive things, you know, motor in a rubber kind of suspension, and then the whole thing's shaking like crazy, but it's isolated,
yeah,
and then they make it rigid, and then it's vibrating through the whole thing. So you found a way to...
Well, yes, if you picture almost any drive system on a belt-driven turntable, the relationship between the belt pulley and the subplatter is such that when the motor starts up, and that's the only energy in a turntable, is the motor.
Right.
And it puts that energy through the pulley system into the drive belt. Immediately, one side of the drive belt, which is going to the subplatter, is under tension, and the other side is under compression. So you naturally have, you know, just laws of physics, really, you have a push and a pull going on. And again, you can exaggerate that by having a wobbly motor mount, for example. So you actually exacerbate it. You make the compression and the tension worse and worse and worse.
Yep.
And therefore, your speed control of the turntable gets affected. You know, it's like the railway train when it pulls away, particularly the old steam ones, because they only had two or three pistons.
Yep.
So they would tug on all the carriages, and then the carriages would lag behind, they'd fall back, and then they would pick up on that force and lurch forward. They would then hit the locomotive, that would then set off again, and you know, you get that forwards
yep.
back energy
yep.
thing, all harmful to the performance of a turntable, you know. So
yep.
again, we focus down on this area, and this turntable has this new mounting system to improve that characteristic.
Oh, well, a lot to pack into one turntable that looks very similar
yeah.
to an older
yeah.
turntable. So that's great.
Yeah, absolutely. If you really look for detail, you'll see even the form of the pulleys changed. We examine every last millimeter of the product.
Yeah. Well, Phil, thanks so much for taking this amount of time and explaining in such great detail what you've done, which is pretty impressive.
Well, it's my pleasure, you know, and thanks so much for being interested as ever, Mike.
I am interested as ever, and I will remain so for the foreseeable future.
yeah, well, you know, it's we're lucky, aren't we, when we get our occupation is about music. So,
and we're lucky that this whole thing's come back the way it's come back, and it's a dream come true. It's beyond a dream come true, because in my wildest dreams, I didn't expect it to come back the way it's come back.
No, and just to finish on one of my favourite little anecdotes, I'm sure I bored you with this one before, but there was a guy in the UK in the 1980s that owned and was running a company called Nitec that made, you know, a popular amplifier,
right.
tuner, etc. A guy called Richard Hay, who's sadly gone now. He's a nice guy, Richard. And I remember him ringing me up in 1984 because... in the UK, everyone was just starting to listen to the first, it may have been a Denon CD player. And he rang me up and he said, Phil, you said, what are you going to be doing next year, he said, when you're not making tone arms anymore?
I've heard the same thing with me. It was,
what are you going to write about when this that's what John Atkinson said to me when I said I want to write a column about vinyl when I joined Stereophonic. He said, well, it's going to go away in a couple of years. What are you going to do? And I said, I don't think it's going to go away, but if it does, I'll find something else to do that I like to do. And it won't be in this business, because if I have to listen to CDs to write about music, I'm not going to be writing that much that's new. And even now, you know, I just bought one of the most expensive and highly regarded SACD players, and it's great, and it makes all my digital sound better than I ever thought it could sound, but it's still not analog.
Yeah,
it's not.
Dig out one of your top 50 analog recorded pieces of vinyl and stick it on a P3, and it's going to trouble your SACD player.
Yeah, it's not as good. All right.
Yeah.
Well, anyway,
okay, mate.
Thanks so much for taking the time, Phil, and I hope I'll see you at some point in the near future.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
okay.
Thanks, Mike.
You bet.
Cheers, mate.
Bye-bye.
Bye.